Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. We live in a golden age of dragons in fiction. They were in Game of Thrones, they were in the Hobbit movies, they'll most likely be in the Amazon series based on the works of J.R.R. Tolkien set in the Second Age of Middle-earth. But dragon myths go back two millennia. They can be found in ancient Greece, in India, in China, and they're in so many different places. This is one of the main arguments by cryptozoologists, that dragons actually exist. Well, I won't be making the argument that dragons exist in this episode. In fact, you can go back in the archives and find an episode I did called Dragons Don't Exist. So why are they in every culture's mythology on Earth? But I'm going to be talking to Scott Bruce, who is a medieval scholar, and he's the author of the new book, The Penguin Book of Dragons, who looks at dragon myths throughout the ages. We explore the origins in the deserts of Africa, their struggles with their mortal enemies, elephants in the jungles of South Asia, their fear of lightning. We'll look at the world's first dragon slayer, which are found in the ancient collections of Sanskrit hymns, and how they can be found in all sorts of religious texts, including them being depicted as a Leviathan in the Old Testament, or the seven-headed great red dragon in the Book of Revelations. Other dragon myths include the Loch Ness Monster, the dragon in Beowulf, who inspired Smaug in Tolkien's The Hobbit, the dragons in the prophecies of the wizard Merlin, a dragon saved from a centipede in Japan who gives his human savior a magical bag of rice, the supernatural feathered serpent of ancient Mesopotamia, and a flatulent dragon the size of a Trojan horse. Scott and I will also dig into obscure early modern and 19th century sources, like reports of dragon sightings from two American newspapermen, and also talk about what it says about our culture today in the 21st century, why we're so fascinated with dragons, and what it means that so often in our fiction, we show dragons as being tamed, and how it's sort of a psychological projection of how we're trying to tame all the dangerous things in our society today. To leave off this intro, we'll close with a quote from Ursula Le Guin, who says, "People who deny the existence of dragons are often eaten by dragons," something to be concerned about. I apologize in advance for my voice. I'm overcoming a cold, and what can I say, listeners? This happens sometimes, but it was worth it to be able to do this interview, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Scott Bruce. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, dragons are very interesting. When it comes to the cryptozoology community of people who believe in animals that aren't verified to exist, there's a lot out there. There's chupacabras, Bigfoot, Nessie, but I have to give it to people who really believe in dragons because I think they have the strongest case. There are all sorts of ancient accounts of them in societies that had no contact with each other. In the Old Testament, you have the Leviathan. In the New Testament, you have the seven-headed dragon. You have the dragon in Beowulf, the dragons in the prophecies of the wizard Merlin. You have dragons in the New World, in ancient Mesoamerica. So let's say dragons don't exist. Why do they appear in so many sources from civilizations that had no contact with one another?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that my answer to this question is in part inflected by the fact that I think I am a believer in the dragon, the historical dragon. But it was certainly interesting to me is that I agree with you. All these different cultures manifested something in accounts of these giant reptilian creatures. And first glance, they do seem to have a great deal in common. There are, you know, hypotheses as to why this is the case. Perhaps we all share a kind of primordial fear of a large reptilian creatures that used to eat up our ancestors. But when you look very closely at dragons and in accounts from different cultures around the world, what we find is that each account is inflected to reflect, as it were, the, you know, what that culture needed in a dragon. So, for instance, dragons are not uniformly hostile or bad or evil. They are, in some cultures, and certainly in Western cultures, we do see that to be the case. But in certain Eastern cultures, stories told about dragons have dragons present dragons very specifically as the allies of human beings, and in fact, sometimes seeking out the help of human beings. So, well, every culture seems to need a dragon, and in my mind, the value of the dragon is not so much the creature itself, but what it tells us about the heroes who confront dragons. We all expect, many different human cultures expect different things of their heroes. And so it really depends on the culture's criteria for what heroism is. If you are from a Western culture that is inflected in martial terms, that is, the prowess of our heroes comes from their being able to defeat large aggressive creatures, then dragons are going to be antagonistic. If you are from a culture where your warriors are esteemed because they are helpful, their heroism comes from them standing up to something that is malevolent, you know, for other people or for other creatures, then we see them as allies. So they, you know, it really is culturally specific. But every culture does seem to need a dragon. It's hard to find a culture that doesn't have one. But when you go below the surface, you know, beyond the simple large reptilian thing, we find cultural inflections and nuances that suggest that they're not all talking about the same thing. They're all these different cultures encode their dragons, as it were, differently.
And this will be very useful to look at different cultures and how they've understood this myth. Mm-hmm. Before getting into that, though, I enjoy stories that are interesting, even if they're apocryphal or downright invented. And we were talking before the show on some of our favorite explanations of where dragon myths come from. I like one by Carl Sagan, who explains that fear of them was imprinted in our mammalian ancestors of fear of dinosaurs. And I thought, wow, 65 million years is a very long time to carry a genetic imprinted fear, because as if modern humans don't have enough neuroses, we have to carry millions and millions and millions of years of our ancestors' neuroses as well. Talk about family baggage. What are some of your favorite explanations, even if they're not true, or especially if they're not true?
Well, David Jones, about 20 years ago, wrote a book called An Instinct for Dragons that picks up, I think, on what Carl Sagan says. Not that these are, you know, ancestral memories of dinosaurs per se, because they were getting a little sketchy with the history, but certainly that the dragons are amalgams of all the different large predators that human beings were once frightened of, or that could have threatened them. So the reason they're monstrous is that they're not any one creature. They're a number of creatures put together, whether that's a combination of lions and crocodiles and large winged raptors. That has slightly more plausibility to me. But as a historian, you know, I need texts to help prove anything beyond a shadow of a doubt. And even then, there's a shadow of a doubt. So, but that thesis about us having an instinctual fear of these kind of creatures, it's popular with students. It's fun to teach with, but that's my go-to at the moment.
Well, to be fair, the megafauna of the Ice Age was pretty terrifying. So it's a plausible explanation, but I agree with you that allegation needs to be a little bit more strongly sourced. Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the myths in different civilizations, because I think this is a good way to triangulate and get a look at what some of the universal characteristics of what dragons are. So perhaps we could look to what might be more familiar to our audience in the move out. So in the ancient Western world, what were dragon myths? And then we can move east to India and China and whatever you think is a good direction to go.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So, you know, the book begins in ancient Greece and Rome and some of the stories about dragons from those cultures. And they tend to fall very, very broadly into two categories. Dragons are almost always large beasts that live in the wilderness. In the ancient world, they are almost always serpents. That is, they're usually referred to, and they're almost never winged either. They're usually large snakes. They are often in place because the gods have assigned them a role in guarding a particular holy site, like a holy well, or some place that's particularly special to the gods. But in some cases, they're also just found in the wild, as it were, in the remotest regions of the known world to the Greeks and the Romans. So, for instance, when we see Romans campaigning in North Africa against the Carthaginians, one of the stories in the book talks about an encounter between a Roman legion and a dragon in the wilds of Africa. This was a large serpent that lived near a lake, of colossal size. And it comes out of its lair and it breathes its kind of fetid breath upon the troops. And due to the heroism of their squad leader, they are able to kill it with the weapons of war that they have with them. They're on horses with chariots and they have spears, but they also have catapults that they use against it. And many people die in the battle, but when they finally end up killing it, we see it's a kind of, they sing the praises of the leader of their troop. And they even mention that they skin the animal and they bring the skin back and the jaws back to Rome, where they're put on display in the forum, and they measure 120 feet in length. So this was really a colossal creature. But when you unpack that story a little further, you can see that the Roman poet who wrote the story was very much interested in presenting the Carthaginians and their homeland in North Africa as a kind of wild and uncivilized place. And so this giant monster becomes kind of representative of Carthaginian culture, which of course is then laid low by the heroism of a Roman commander. So we're operating on two different levels here. It seems like an encounter with a monster in the wild, but at the same time, it's very much coded by the Roman author to say, this is how Romans tame the wild, whether the wild is a giant monster or non-Roman people. That story got repeated and repeated as medieval monks copied those Roman poets and medieval people, people in medieval Europe read the story. And sometimes even there's a case of a 12th century manuscript of the story where a 12th century monastic scribe wrote dragon in the margin, because even though the story describes it as a giant snake, he recognized it as a dragon. So dragons are very much alive and well in the Greek and Roman world, but they tend to be on the fringes of that world. And we see this with many, with monsters throughout the Western tradition. You never talk about you rarely talk about the monster in your backyard. You almost always talk about the monster that is just beyond the place that you've conquered, or dwelling among the people that you've recently conquered, but as evidence that they required conquering because they too were, as wild and savage as the monsters that dwell among them. Those places tend to be, all around, you think of the Mediterranean as being the center of Greek and Roman influence. So the further south you get into Africa, the further east you go towards India. And then in the Middle Ages, the further north you go towards Scandinavian countries, that's where the monsters are.
In the marginalia of different maps, this is where the sea monsters are. And there's different explanations for that I've read, partly that you're purchasing an expensive manuscript, so you need as much artistry on there as you possibly can, and basically sure. Get as much bang for your buck. But then also Roman era geographers were doing their best to understand the natural world. Mm-hmm. Someone explained that for every animal on land, there was a counterpart at sea, and we still bear the names of some of these creatures today, seahorses and the like. And they're also relying on information from sailors who were typically uneducated, and with many nights out in the sun, drinking too much rum, their imagination could get the best of them. Was there any sort of natural philosophical attempt to add some sort of scientific foundation to these dragon legends in the ancient world?
Well, that's a wonderful question. So some of these ancient accounts come out of works that are self-consciously natural histories, and in the first century CE, Pliny's natural history is probably the greatest example. This is Pliny the Elder, the uncle of Pliny the Younger, who wrote voluminous letters and described the destruction of Vesuvius at the end of the first century, which killed his uncle, which killed Pliny the Elder. But Pliny the Elder's encyclopedic natural history is one of the places where we see commentaries on dragons. He puts dragons in India, and he talks about them very specifically in terms of their relationship with elephants. And he wants there to be a kind of natural explanation. Like for him, dragons are a creature that live in a foreign land. They're large. And by his description, they just seem to be like boa constrictors. They're very large snakes. But he's very, very interested in talking about their role in the ecosystem, and especially their antagonistic relationship with elephants. And he does so without any kind of, it's seemingly without any kind of message, other than this is the way the world works, and these are these strange animals that live in this other place. And the relationship, obviously, as I was saying, is a bad one, right? The elephants try and trample the so-called dragons. The so-called dragons wrap around them and try and knock them down, and they bite their eyes out, and these kind of drink their blood. And so it's a nasty relationship between the two of them. Christian moralists in the Middle Ages would read Pliny and other authors relying on Pliny's account of the relationship between elephants and dragons, and then begin to assign it an allegorical meaning. And the point, one of the reasons why these stories were popular in the Middle Ages is because they were ripe for allegory. And so the dragon then becomes the devil, because there's all this history in the, you know, through the Hebrew scriptures of the relationship between the devil and the serpent in the Garden of Eden, or the devil as the serpent in the Garden of Eden. And so when Christian authors are reading these texts and saying, oh, well, this is a serpent too, and look at it, it's being kind of nasty to this elephant, they saw there a Christian allegory for the devil's attempt to, you know, to ensnare human souls. And so what began as a so-called natural history, that is an account of natural phenomena in the world by a Roman author, then became an allegorical Christian story about the way the devil endangers souls.
Well, I'll definitely come back to that, because as we get yes. into the modern era, when we talk about vampire myths, also ties into a lot of this. But let's move to other civilizations, because I'd love to hear how they talk about it, since you mentioned that dragons are a vessel through which societies impute their morals. So let's take the case of India and China. What are their dragon myths?
Well, so I was frankly, so one of the things I loved about doing this book was it gave me the opportunity to take a global approach to a mythological phenomenon. Previous books that I'd done about, for Penguin Classics, about the undead and about the infernal punishment and the afterlife had narrower, you know, their purview was a little narrower, in part simply because I don't have facility in any of the Eastern languages necessary to read these texts. I was really hoping, given the amount of dragon imagery that I'd seen in Asian cultures, especially East Asian cultures, that I was going to find some excellent dragon stories. And so I did what I thought was responsible, and I contacted friends and colleagues of mine who were Asian historians, and I said, please tell me about the dragons in the cultures you study. And nobody was able to really come up with a really, really good, rich kind of dragon story that rivaled, say, Beowulf for Western Europe, you know, of the archetypal hero fighting against a dragon that we recognize as a dragon. Now, some of the early myths that we have from India, and these are in the book, they're wonderful, but they're incredibly short. And they do have to do with, you know, with heroes who defeat dragons. The dragons in those cases are usually seen as being evil because they control water. And they hoard water, they thereby create drought. And if you kill the dragon, then the water is let loose and people can, you know, have the water that they need. But by the time we get to medieval China and medieval Japan, I was disappointed to find that there were no epics that I could indulge myself in and my readers in. Rather, what I found was dragons were largely emblematic. They had a symbolic importance. They appeared in iconography. They appeared strangely in medical texts because their bones were thought to have medicinal purposes. And that's where we get the most vivid descriptions of them as kind of composite creatures. They appear in historical writings only insofar as sightings of them were portents of bad things that were going to happen. And we see that in Western Europe too. But it's really not until the 16th and 17th centuries that we begin to see dragons appear as protagonists in stories. And there, they tend to be somewhat more sympathetic. Unlike Western dragons, they talk. And, you know, from our modern point of view, if you informed yourself about dragons simply from modern culture, so like simply from, let's say, the big one, like Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones and those kind of things, you would immediately think, A, all dragons, you know, have some capacity for speech or communication with human beings, at least. I know Daenerys Targaryen's dragons don't speak, but she does have a kind of relationship with them. And you would think that women were an important part of dragon stories, and you would generally think of dragons as being bad and antagonistic. But for early modern people, they would not, most cultures, certainly Western cultures, dragons do not speak at all. They're completely bestial. And women play almost no role in dragon stories in the pre-modern tradition. It's almost entirely a man's domain, and there's a few exceptions that I can talk about. But in the Eastern stories, what was quite fascinating was that when we do begin to get narratives of involving dragons in the early modern period and in the 19th century, the dragons almost always speak. And because they speak, they are at least sympathetic. They tend to be sympathetic to human beings. That is, they often come to human beings asking for help, or they respond when human beings inadvertently help them. And so the stories are immediately much more incredibly rich because they're about the dragon and they're about the hero, rather than the long pre-modern Western tradition where the dragons are described occasionally. They're understood to be a menace, but they're almost always about the valor of the hero rather than the dragon itself.
That's very interesting. Let's say with the place of the dragon in Chinese myth, that it sounds like they weren't terribly significant until the early modern period, which is interesting because you associate them so much with Chinese symbology. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I was never, none of my Asian historian friends could answer the question for me. And many of them had studied, you know, had gone looking for dragons in their work. And you know, there was a particularly difficult period in Chinese history in the late, in the late 16th century, when dragons were cropping up all over the place in historical chronicles. And it was a time of great political uncertainty, and the dragons simply reflected the uncertainty. You know, people started seeing dragons because things were not going well, and they were a portent that things would continue to not go well. But nobody ever sat down to craft, you know, an epic story about a hero fighting dragons, and which is what we're used to from the West. And I was, you know, I was, again, like I said, was disappointed not to find one, because like you, I was fully expecting, given the richness of the kind of pageantry involving dragons that I was familiar with from Eastern cultures, I thought I would find more.
Yeah, I mean, this is an example of poor anthropology, but when I think of Chinese restaurants, about 50% of them have the word dragon in there somewhere. Red dragon, lucky dragon. Now, definitely not a good way to assess Chinese culture by the name of Chinese restaurants.
Well, no, but like you said, there, like that just goes to show, like there's an emblematic quality to them. They have a power. They have an evocative power, but nobody's written a story about them. You know, no medieval or early modern person wrote the lasting epic about them, I guess is the way to say it. Now, they do turn up fascinatingly in as I was saying, in medicinal texts. And so we know that when large bones washed up in major rivers, and these could very well and probably were dinosaur bones, that they were gathered as dragon bones, and they were highly valued for their medicinal properties. And medical treatises from early modern China describe the different parts of dragons and the kind of composite nature of dragons, how they are not really a creature unto themselves, but they're a composite of all sorts of different kinds of creatures, and how different parts of them have medicinal value. And so they're in people's imagination, but in a way that's completely different than the Western presentation that we're used to, and that modern fantasy borrows so much from, frankly.
Right. Listeners, if they want to, there was an episode I did. If you just Google Dragons Don't Exist plus History Unplugged, you can find it where I look in these myths. And Scott, you might remember, or this might be closer to your mind than it is mine at the moment, but I remember an anthropology text I read that made the argument that dragons exist universally in different cultures because there's some sort of subconscious representation of water and rain. Mm-hmm. And what you're describing here in Chinese or other Eastern sources, that they appear when they hoard water, and when they're defeated, then water is released. So rainbows are also a symbol of dragons, that after rain has come, then they're this as well. And damming up water and the control of waterways and their role in, let's say, Chinese history is something that's done a lot for the development of that nation. So with that different development of that culture, it makes a lot of sense that dragons would also be depicted differently.
Indeed. And just for your listeners, the text in question is the Rig Veda, which is an ancient Sanskrit text. In fact, and I think it qualifies as the first dragon story that we have in human literature, given its age. It's very, like I said, very, very short, but there it is all about water. Yes, he's the dragon of drought, as it were, because by slaying the dragon, then the river flows again. And the importance of water in pre-modern cultures really doesn't need to be emphasized. And we also have them, again, many pre-modern naturalists, in thinking about dragons, when they don't know where to put them in the water. You know, they are considered to be water-dwelling creatures, and if they don't dwell in the water, they certainly dwell near it, generally speaking.
Before jumping to the medieval era, can you tell me about some of the texts in your book that are translated into English from Latin, and any interesting things you noticed there?
Yeah, so there's texts translated from many languages in the book. Me and some of my students actually also took part in translating many of the Latin texts, but for the languages that I am not as proficient in, or not remotely proficient in, Old English, Medieval Greek, I farmed out some of the work of translating to some colleagues of mine who I knew had an expertise and who were interested in the topic. So that was, it's a wonderful, and then in some cases, in the case of Sanskrit and the Asian languages, I relied on translations by people I didn't know. What's so striking about this is that we very confidently use the term dragon when we discuss these creatures, but the nomenclature for these animals was varied and sometimes ambiguous. So for instance, as I was saying that, you know, it's very clear that while the word Draco is used by ancient Greeks and Romans, that word has a kind of semantic slippage and often means something more akin to a snake than it does to what we think of as a dragon. That is, it means a large reptile that doesn't have limbs and doesn't have wings. And it's really only in the early medieval period that we begin to see winged dragons. And no one has ever explained to me why that is the case. I've yet to find, you know, why dragons change shape when we get to Northern Europe in the early Middle Ages. But there, too, we see the language, you know, the language used to discuss dragons is different. We get the introduction of the, Scandinavian word worm, W-Y-R-M in this case, again, for a large undulating reptilian creature that probably does have legs and wings, because then we begin to see depictions of them flying and grasping things rather than coiling around them. But why that change takes place, I do not know. And this is where, you know, the language, the interacting with these texts in their original language, you begin to see that many of the things that we take for granted with a homogenizing term like dragon, it becomes much more complicated because you have to be a little bit more responsible about how you render the words when the description isn't what you expect of a dragon.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
Are you a man who thinks about the Roman Empire at least once a day? According to a recent internet meme, you definitely do. And why shouldn't you? Here's a clip from Tom Holland talking about Rome at the very height of its power.
When tourists go to the Colosseum, they're not really going there, I suspect, most of them, because they're admirers of Flavian architecture. I suspect that they're going there because it's the kind of the shiver that you get of going to a place where blood sports have happened.
To listen to more of this discussion, check out the History Unplugged podcast on the podcast player of your choice.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear you chart the evolution of dragons over the medieval period. And let me describe where I'm coming from with this. I did an episode. Somebody asked me about whether Vlad Dracul is the direct inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula. Vlad the Impaler was a monarch in Wallachia who used psychological terror tactics against the Ottomans, against a superior force, by impaling tens of thousands of people. And I read a master's thesis on this topic, and the basic point they were making is that Bram Stoker wasn't really using Vlad Dracul as much as borrowing from the imagery of dragons as sort of as the devil, and the vampire mythology is sort of the photo negative of Christianity, where sucking the blood for immortality is a mockery of the Eucharist. There's a resurrection, but it's a false resurrection. So vampires are sort of a photo negative of Christianity, and Bram Stoker arguably took that from dragon myth, which also dragon is synonymous with the devil, and that's the Christian influence there. Mm-hmm. Now, the use of the word dragon is in the Book of Revelation. It goes back to the first century, but as you point out, the idea of a dragon evolves over time, so there's nothing static at all here, even if the language of Christianity has used it for a very long time. So how does the idea of a dragon evolve over the medieval period?
Well, it's a great question. And we have to distinguish two things here. One is that there is a very, very strong Latin Christian tradition that talks about dragons within almost entirely within the context of Christianity. And the other is that there are very equally strong vernacular traditions that communicate stories and traditions that are not Christian. And so the first one, the Latin Christian tradition, is just dominated by allegory. You know, seems like every dragon is some kind of personification of the devil or some agent of the devil, and is usually works in the story as the enemy who is trying to thwart human beings and then is defeated by a saintly figure of some kind or other, usually a man, but in one or two rare cases, a woman. So dragons, to me, it's interesting. As a medievalist, I find medieval European dragons in the Christian Latin tradition, which is exactly what I study, the least interesting dragons, because they are so dominated by allegory. Now, there's one or two exceptions that I'll share with you that I think are wonderful. Because if you know the punchline of every story is, oh, the dragon's the devil, or oh, the dragon is a demon in disguise, oh, and the saint is going to, you know, defeat them, then, you know, the story gets old pretty quickly. But there are a few cases where Christian authors, in describing dragons and dragon lore, give away their non-Christian sources, or at least their non-sanctioned sources. So one of my favorite texts in the book, which I translated alongside my doctoral candidate student, Ben Bertrand, is by a 12th century Christian author, and he's describing various customs of the church. Mainly he's talking about Christian feast days, the feast days of the saints, and the different ceremonies that took place on those days. And when he begins talking about the feast day of John the Baptist, which takes place in June, I think it's June 23rd or 24th, he notes this strange tradition, or to him it's a strange tradition, that people would light bonfires on the day of John's, you know, when they celebrated the death of John the Baptist. And so he has some explanations for this, and one of them is that, you know, John was the forerunner of Jesus, and therefore he brought the light to the world, and it's appropriate that people light bonfires on that day because it acknowledges John's role as an evangelist. But he also says that the bonfires had a different origin, an alternate origin. And these are not just simple fires. They're fires made of animal bones. So people gather the bones of cattle, for instance, and they set them ablaze, and they create a lot of smoke and a certain kind of smell. And this Christian author shares with us, Belleth is his name, by the way, he shares with us this tradition that is not a Christian tradition, and he doesn't sanction it, but weirdly, he doesn't deny it either. And he says, well, these fires made of bones were used in the summertime to ward off dragons. The reason being that in the summer months, dragons went basically in heat, and they would fly around and they would ejaculate semen all over the landscape. And if that got into your river or your well, then that would poison your water source. But they were kept at bay by bonfires, by these fires that were made of bones. And so the root of our modern bonfire is the bone fire that kept the dragons from tainting your water. And so he has this as a kind of, well, this is what some people think about this, but really we should light these fires because of John the Baptist. But in doing so, gives away this amazingly rich little piece of dragon lore from the 12th century, and undoubtedly earlier than that, that still lives with us in our modern vocabulary. Because I bet you when you go out on an autumn night and someone asks to light a bonfire, they don't know the origin of the word that they're evoking. So look up in the sky and look up for the dragons. But for the most part, Christian authors aren't as revealing as Belleth was in the 12th century. And they give us this pretty standard story about the way dragons are, you know, allegorized as the devil. Now, Northern European cultures writing in vernacular languages, whether Old English or Old Norse or, you know, Northern languages like that, they come to us with their own rich traditions about what dragons are and the relationship between dragons and heroes that have actually very little to do with Christianity. Sometimes they are retold in the Christian era and they're given a slight Christian veneer. But for instance, Beowulf is the best example of this. You know, we know that Beowulf was more than likely written down around the year 1000 in a manuscript, probably by a Christian priest who was sympathetic to the story and maybe also read it allegorically. But certainly the original Beowulf story that he was writing down was a couple of hundred years older, perhaps from, 700 or 800 or thereabouts. And the dragon, as it appears in Beowulf, has to be considered as part of a suite of monsters that includes Grendel and Grendel's mother, the terrible creatures that Beowulf defeats in the process of his heroic life in the poem. And it's very clear, historians have picked apart these stories and literary scholars have picked apart these stories where those monsters are very much encoded with the values of the people who are telling the story. Grendel and his mother representing this kind of uncontrollable violence of the kind these northern cultures feared. And the dragon was a hoarder of wealth, and wealth in the poem is very clear. It's the kind of social glue that makes society function. Wealth is, war leaders take wealth through conquest and they don't keep it. They don't hoard it. They redistribute it among their companions and thereby gain their loyalty and thereby, gain solidarity within that society. If you have a monster that hoards wealth, well, it's not just that it is covetous, it's also taking away the means by which you create the glue that allows your society to hold together. And so there are, these stories, not just dragons, but all sorts of monsters have these encoded cultural values. Very different from Christianity, but also that tradition, in fact, is the one that did the most to inform modern fantasy, in part because we have to blame Tolkien here with the best possible intentions, because he, of course, was a scholar of Old English. He knew the Beowulf dragon tradition very, very well, the Scandinavian dragon tradition very, very well. And he translated many of those into, Smaug, the greatest dragon of the 20th century, probably the modern world, except the Smaug could talk.
Right.
And the dragons of that culture did not talk for the most part.
A nice synthesis right there.
sorry, yes. Yeah. Perhaps too long, sir.
Well, you alluded to dragon stories with female protagonists. So yes. What are these and what do you think the reason is that the writers had for making them female?
Well, in this case, it's both of the stories of female protagonists that I include in the Penguin Book of Dragons come from the Legenda Aurea, the Golden Legend, a massive 13th century collection of saints' lives. And the saints in question are Martha and Margaret. And in both cases, what we have is a woman, in this case, Saint Margaret, and the story of Margaret is set, in the late Roman Empire when Christianity is still outlawed, and she is, captured for being a Christian, and she's going to be put to death, and a dragon comes to her in her cell, and she defeats the dragon by praying inside the dragon's stomach. And she miraculously bursts out of the dragon, thereby killing it. And the story was, read as her, her virtue as a virgin. It's typical in these stories, when she's imprisoned, the local Roman pagan prefect falls in love with her and wants to wed her, but she resists because he's a pagan and because she wants to preserve her virginity. And the power of, the saintly power that comes from her being a virgin and so devout to Christ allows her to withstand being digested by this dragon and indeed leads to the dragon's hideous demise. Some of the depictions of this in medieval manuscripts are particularly gory, and it's perhaps maybe no surprise that Margaret becomes the patron saint of childbirth, due in part to this strange anecdote. But even Jacobus de Voragine, the man who compiled the Golden Legend, was dubious about the story. He wrote, according to another account, in one version of the story, she makes the sign of the cross and the dragon disappears. But he writes, according to another account, the dragon got its jaws over Margaret's head and its tongue round her feet and swallowed her. And it was while it was attempting to digest her that she armed herself with the sign of the cross. And this proved too much for the dragon, who burst apart and the virgin emerged unhurt. But this story of the dragon devouring the virgin, he wrote, and then bursting apart, is considered apocryphal and of no historical value. It might have a devotional value if it can inspire faith among the faithful, but even he thought that was a little much. Yet another of the female Christian saints to encounter a dragon was Saint Martha. But in her case, she meets a monster that lurks near a river and kills everyone that comes by, and the people beg Martha to help them. And when she finds it, she throws some blessed water on it, and she holds up the cross, and the dragon is just completely cowed and stands there meek as a lamb, as the text puts it. And she ties her girdle around it and leads it back to town, where some townspeople kill it with spears and stones. So there again, it's a model of heroism that has to do with her you know, the inner power that she has, the inner sanctity that she has due to her virginity that allows her to tame the animal using the sign of the cross, and then other people kill it. She's not a warrior in any respect, nor was Margaret before her. And so those are two of the very rare stories that we have of females who are of female characters who interact with dragons in a meaningful way. For the most part, even in many of these stories, there's, you know, we think about the damsel in distress in terms of stereotypical dragon stories, but those aren't actually really part of pre-modern stories at all. The damsel in distress isn't for large part a product of the 19th century revival of medieval stories, you know, medievalism, an interest in the Gothic, an interest in these old time stories. But there was a real misrepresentation of how the medieval stories worked. Women played very little role at all in them.
So much of our understanding of the medieval stories about dragons, the St. George and the dragon, are really 19th century retellings.
Yeah. George was in the Legenda Aurea too, and there is a story about him there. And in fact, it's the George story that really is the result of this, because now that you mentioned George, of course, there is a damsel in distress in that story. So I have to retract a little bit. So that is a story in which a dragon plagues a local kingdom, and the king, you know, there's a lottery system that's put into place where the children of the kingdom are sent off to be eaten by the dragon once a month. And when it comes time, when the king's daughter draws a bad lot, he wants to say, no, you shouldn't go. And of course the townspeople say, well, of course she's going to go. It's her turn. And that's who George finds out in the wilderness waiting to be eaten by a dragon as this young woman. And he defeats the dragon. So, but that's the story that becomes the ubiquitous 19th century story about how dragons work, how Christian knights work. It's the one when 19th century authors look back at the kind of rich panoply of dragon stories that they inherited from the Middle Ages, they latched onto George. That's the one that satisfied them most. And it was also widely lampooned. I mean, this is one of the fun things about early modern and 19th century literature, is that, you know, they also got tired of dragon stories, of these kind of traditional dragon stories, and they like to, you know, they like to make fun of them. And but that, we can save that for a little bit.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Also, getting into the 20th century, you mentioned there are newspaper accounts of dragon sightings. So what's going on here? Is there some sort of moral panic or mass psychosis, or this is embedded so successfully in the public imagination that people are seeing things?
Yeah, well, I think this goes back to whether there's historical veracity in these stories, I don't know. But what this goes back to, though, is it goes back to the Roman trope of, you put dragons on the fringe of civilization. You don't, you know, dragons don't appear in Times Square in New York or wherever you can see them. They appear on the outermost limits of your borders, where very few people are. And so these dragon encounters that are described in modern American newspapers from the late, it's usually in the last decades of the 19th century, dragons tend to appear, New Mexico, in California, you know, in the wild frontiers, you know, whether out in the desert in the case of New Mexico, or in the forests, the dense forests. And they tend to be found by, you know, remote ranchers or tree cutters or whomever's in that territory. So it's very, very hard to verify the story. What they actually encountered, I don't know exactly. But the tall tales, you know, the tales come back, and And when you're the journalist at the, Arizona Tombstone or whatever the name of the paper is, you know, and you hear a good story, you're going to put it in the paper. I was shocked to find them, absolutely delighted to find them, because I didn't think America would play any part in my story. I was happy to see that some of the last modern dragon sightings we have are these ones that take place, you know, here in the States. Of course, you know, Nessie plays a role in the book too, you know, a perennial serpentine water monster who first appears in early 8th century Latin text, The Life of St. Columba, who encounters the monster and turns it away with the sign of the cross. But, you know, sightings of Nessie persist almost to the present day, in no small part because until very recently, the north of Scotland was so remote. So it's a shame, really, because when we've exhausted, you know, Google Maps, I guess, will be the final end to all dragons, because when we can look at every part of the earth simultaneously, then there's no place left for the dragons to go except deep underground or deep underwater or way up into space, I guess. So I have no lunar dragons yet, but, you know, give it time.
Yeah, they're hibernating deep under the core of the earth, or as Godzilla versus Kong has showed us earlier this year, the center of the earth is hollowed out, and that's where giant apes and dinosaurs fight each other.
Well, that's just good Jules Verne, you
know? Right?
And of course, that's, you know, the subterranean dragon was very popular in the early modern period for the same kind of reasons. One of my favorite authors who appears in the book is an early modern polymath named Anastasius Kirchner, and he wrote a wonderful, massive book called Mundus Subterrana, the world below, as it were, and included descriptions of all sorts of different creatures that lived underneath the ground, including dragons and other mythological creatures, giants, other things too, in addition to all manner of natural phenomena. And so already in the early modern period, dragons were on the retreat. They were only found in, you know, remote mountain passes and caves and underground, or again, the furthest parts of the world.
Well, they've obviously made a huge comeback in fiction. Game of Thrones, How to Train a Dragon, everything Tolkien, you could imagine. I mean, I could just sit here and prattle on different properties for hours, but what do you think is the contemporary interest in them? And I don't want to say what they get wrong, because there's not really a way to get dragons wrong, but what do you think it says about our culture with what we impute into dragons compared to the way older cultures imputed their values into dragons?
Well, one of the things that we successfully managed to do that ancients never did, or medieval people never did, was we've tamed them. We've domesticated them. And we did so starting in the late 19th century in children's literature. So the Penguin Book of Dragons ends with two short stories that were written for children in the late 19th and early 20th century that were written in direct response to the unbelievably popular stories of St. George that we're all so familiar with that were circulating at the time. And they tried to turn these stories on their heads by presenting dragons that were not antagonistic, but friendly. And then the problem of the friendly dragon, and they almost always solved these in the two stories in question, the problem was solved by children. That is, children were sympathetic to dragons. They did not feel dragons were naturally their enemies. They treated the dragons with kindness and found them to be rather charming and talkative and whatnot. And then they tried their best to save the dragons. And so around the year 1900, we begin to see a really radical change in the expectation of what a dragon story could be when we see children harnessing dragons through kindness to serve their own purposes and not nefarious purposes. You know, they become friendly. They fly the children around on their backs. They become their companions and they write poetry with them. They're these quaint, you know, kind of almost scholarly figures. And it's those stories that really open up a new way of talking about dragons and what becomes modern fantasy literature. Now, Tolkien, of course, would have none of that. He was not interested in taming dragons. He was interested in showing dragons and the terrifying glory of Northern Europe in the early Middle Ages, what we're familiar with from Beowulf. But other authors did. And so we have, you know, in the 1940s, we have My Father's Dragon, a very popular story that still I have many interlocutors and colleagues who are in their 70s and 80s who fondly remember that story from their childhood. We have, you know, numerous stories about the taming of dragons. Ursula Le Guin is actually, you know, she falls back to an older tradition that's more akin to Tolkien. But even George Martin's dragons as weapons of war is still a domestication of sorts. These are, you know, the dragons in that story are not wild creatures that are, you know, just, you know, menacing humankind. They're almost always the agents of human beings. And so without these children's stories from the late 19th century, we don't have all the charming stories and not so charming stories about dragons befriending or being used by human beings. And the domestication of dragons is just one stage in a wider domestication of the supernatural and the until then mythological, that takes place over the course of the 19th century. So for instance, angels are another great example. Angels are they're literally awe-inspiring, right? They inspire awe and fright in pre-modern people. Accounts of angels are usually very fraught because they terrify the people they talk to. And now angels are these kind of boring, sentimental, you know, creatures.
Chubby babies.
Who are super, yeah, they're like, you know, they're super sympathetic to us now. And I mean, and sometimes this is absolutely, I mean, this can be portrayed lyrically and beautifully, like in Wim Wenders' film, The Wings of Desire. Ghosts are another great example. Ghosts still scare us, but then who can think of ghosts without thinking of like Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore? And vampires too have now been defanged, you know, as the love interests in Buffy or in, heaven forbid, Twilight or these kind of things. So there's been a massive movement in human culture to domesticate all these things that once frightened us, and dragons were not immune to it. And, you know, the question remains, we still, once you domesticate a dragon, what do you do with it? And then the way the author tells you what they do with it, whether it's a friend or whether you use it to kill other people or dominate other people, says much more about the author and the culture they belong to than it does about the dragon. George R. R. Martin's dragons are very American dragons in my mind. In that sense, they're very belligerent. They don't talk. You know, they just act. And when they act, they tend to act violently. And so there's a kind of, to me, that's a kind of, you know, dumbed down militaristic dragon, which I don't find, you know, I don't find nearly as interesting as even the dragons of, you know, How to Train Your Dragon, for all their kind of silliness. They're at least kind of, you know, they're at least helpful and nice and cute. But anyway, we, as I say in the beginning of the book, we live in the golden age of dragons now. Everyone knows what a dragon is. If you play Pokemon, you collect them. If you play modern role-playing, you know, massively multiplayer role-playing games online, you fight them or not, but they're part of your life. They're just everywhere. You just can't escape them. And, you know, for better or for worse. And that's one of the reasons that I was inspired to do this book, because I knew they had a long and complex history that I wanted to learn more about, and figured many other people with their interest in dragons would be too.
Well, you've given us a tour through history, and you also held up a mirror so we can look at our collective id, which is something that I always like to do in discussion like these. Well, for listeners who want to check out more, and there are many more stories, the name of the book is The Penguin Book of Dragons. Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.